Today I want to talk about how to meet a challenge. Sometimes we think of challenges as demands, chores, jobs, duties, responsibilities, desires, a lot of different ways to look at it. And right now, I happen to be feeling the stress of several or more demands for my attention, my decisions, and my action. They're all competing for my attention along with vacation activities. And so the stress I'm feeling is because I view these situations in certain ways. I make them about me. I think of me in each case rather than of the desired outcome, and I think that's a problem. Maybe you can relate to that. More important still is, in that process, I isolate myself as if I'm the only resource I have in order to accomplish what needs to be done, even if that were clear to me. It feels like my mind constricts or opens a field around me, depending on the level of threat that it perceives in these challenges. What I'm trying to learn to do and to habituate is to call upon the divine for awareness that will make the handling of demands in everyday life as effective as possible. That's process of reaching out to the divine in thought and feeling and asking for enlightenment is repeatedly encouraged by Christ in Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. It's not the first time I heard of it. I admire a guy named Walter Russell. Walter Russell was an American Leonardo da Vinci, died in 1964, limited education, but became world famous in five or six or seven different areas. And Walter Russell did that in his lifetime. He would quiet himself down in prayer and meditation, reach out to what he considered the source of all knowledge, not information, but knowledge, with a question or an idea or a need or a requirement or a challenge, and wait until the clarity of the knowledge of how to handle it came into his mind. I like that. As I practice that, and I'm able to do it some of the time, and other times my awareness is just not there, that I reach out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness, and I ask for the awareness so that I can be more effective. And so really, it's a multi-step process, if you will. I have to reach out in thought and feeling, and I've got to become receptive to that awareness. And then there's an implementation part of that process. So just this idea of focusing on it, and as I was writing about this a few days ago, I could feel a difference in my attitude, in my feelings, in my energy state with regard to the demands or the challenges that needed to be met. And then all of a sudden, instead of seeing it as a demand that was overwhelming or a whole series of them, in fact, I saw it more like a game. And the game is to see how effectively I can function and, frankly, how effectively a play can be called in from the sidelines. Now, if you put that statement in quotes, a play can be called in from the sideline, is because it's a sports metaphor. And if you're familiar with sports, this will make more sense to you. You can recognize that right now in America, there are baseball games going on, there are basketball games and football games and all kinds of games going on. And oftentimes there are information inputs being delivered to the person performing the activity that are coming, the information is coming from outside of the performer. For instance, in baseball, even though the pitcher is the one throwing the ball, he is getting inputs from the catcher as to what to throw. The manager from the dugout is also giving information, and so on. When runners are on base, the third base coach is giving information to the runners, as is the manager in the dugout, as to what to do and what not to do. So all of this information being delivered to pitchers and batters and runners from external sources is real, real common. In professional football in America, the quarterback has a two-way radio in his helmet. This is to enable him to get information from the sidelines as to which play to call in the huddle so he can tell the other 10 guys on his team what they should be doing at any one play. Now, there's an offensive coordinator on the sideline who's calling that play in, but in fact, somebody else is providing input to the offensive coordinator on the sideline who happens to be at ground level. Up higher up in the stadium is a person who is seeing the field from a higher altitude, a higher viewpoint, can see the entire field. It's got computers and TV screens and all kinds of information and assistance to help him see things more globally. And he is the one that's feeding information to the offensive coordinator, who is feeding information to the quarterback, who is feeding information to the other 10 players, and then those 11 guys actually enact the play. Real interesting. I'm saying that reaching out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness and asking for enlightenment, that is, what play should I call, is analogous to these sports practices, but better. If you think of it, all teaching, all learning, all information, all knowledge, all understanding are coming from someplace to us. Pretty much, we either call it forth or we reject it. We call it forth, and then we have to accept its receipt. What could be better than to ask God for awareness of how to be, how to do, and how to have what we think we want in every situation? Seems pretty straightforward that would be a very, very good strategy. Personally, I want to use my mind in order to access the source of all knowledge, just like Walter Russell did, and just like Christ did. And Christ also gave credit to, instead of saying the source of all knowledge or the source of all healing, referred to it, based upon the politics of the time, as God the Father. That source is available to us if we will reach out to it. I think that could be a really cool way to meet a challenge. Another thing that we're going to have to take into consideration to meet a challenge is to define what the challenge is before we can meet it. A goal is not a challenge. The challenge is different than the goal. I would say that the goal is the desire, is where we want to be. It's what we want to attain, either be or do or have. So we've got us right now, and that goal some time in the future, some geography away perhaps, some other way of measuring distance between us and it. But the challenge is in the space between us and our goal. We could look at that challenge as some factor that we don't yet have or be or do. It could be a skill, a knowledge, an ability, an awareness, or so on. It could be mental, so it requires a different way of thinking, and I talked about that earlier, is you can look at a challenge and see it as a threat. You can look at a challenge and see it as fun and a growth opportunity. We may need to change the way we think. It could be an emotional challenge, so we want to feel differently about that. A lot of our emotions are rooted into very early experiences that we've just been repeating robotically for years. And so we may want to go, I want to respond to this emotionally. I need to grow. My challenge is emotional. Or it could be a physical challenge, which could require us to be able to do something physical in a way that at this moment we're not able to do. We don't know how to do, or we're physically not yet capable of doing it. While I believe that creation moves from the unseen to the seen through these levels, right, from the spiritual level to the mental level to the emotional level to the physical level, I also see that physical skills that are needed to meet a physical challenge involve us using the physical body. I like the idea that Anthony Robbins makes pointedly many times in his training, is that if you want to change your mental or emotional state, you can change your physical state first. You can interrupt your physical state and do things differently, and then all of a sudden it ripples upward to those different states of emotional or mental. And I believe this is a fact. But I want to talk about a physical skill here for a second. Let's take typing on a keyboard, typing on a typewriter, that I'll call it keyboarding. That's a physical skill, right? It's a physical process because physical fingers press physical buttons on a keyboard. But in order to do that successfully or meaningfully, the fingers have to press the right buttons in the right sequence. Otherwise, the output, the words on the screen or on the paper, are not going to make much sense to us. So pressing the right buttons in the right sequence requires some sort of mental capability to see or think of a word so we know what the goal word is to be typed, and then have the fingers translate that image, that mental image, into a series of pushes on the keys so what shows up on the screen or the paper is exactly what we wanted. The typist's ability to do this successfully is directly affected by the placement of their wrists and hands on the keyboard. If they have them placed in a consistent location each time they sit down to type, the fingers can learn how to find the letters on the keys and press them. If the wrists are placed in various locations, then what the fingers have learned, that hand intelligence, which I'll talk about, is now all of a sudden much more ambiguous. Instead of that same move each time resulting in an A, S, or a D, or an F, for instance, it now all of a sudden it's unpredictable as to which keys are being hit and which letters show up on the screen or the paper. And that, I can tell you, results in misspellings, backspacing, which is unbelievably tedious, and making a whole lot of corrections. I happen to be on vacation in Punta Mita, Mexico, and one of the things I wanted to do once I got here and I recognized it is I want to learn how to do stand-up paddle boarding. And a couple of days ago in the afternoon, which was, I'm told, to my disadvantage, I went out and tried to do stand-up paddle boarding, and I struggled to maintain my balance standing up. And much like you would guess, stand-up paddle boarding requires the ability to stand up and paddle. So from a placement standpoint, knowing where to place my feet is important, but that's pretty easy to learn. And so the guy said, okay, here's the middle of the board, this is where you're going to kneel, and when you stand up, this is basically where your feet are going to be. It's like, oh, okay, got it. That was pretty easy. But the fact that I couldn't control, the challenge that was much more difficult, was controlling the center of gravity, that is my balance on that board, standing up in the waves. And that resulted in me falling over into the water a lot of times. So there I was, trying to meet this challenge of maintaining my center of gravity standing on a paddleboard so that I would be able to paddle. Frankly, I don't know of any other way to learn to find one's center of gravity on a paddleboard than the practice standing on a paddleboard in the water. Now, the waves have been problematic since then, so I'm looking for an alternative to that, and I think maybe it'll be in a pool with a paddleboard so I can control that environment. And it occurs to me that the way for me to meet this challenge, and the way for us to meet any challenge, is to bond with it, is to combine with this aspect of the challenge. And for me in this particular case, I'm talking about maintaining my balance as I stand up and paddle. So I need to bond with that physical activity by practicing it over and over and over again until I have some sort of awareness. I have some sort of intelligence in my body, in my feet, in my legs, in my core that gives me the ability to maintain this. And frankly, I believe that as I get a little bit better at doing that, is now it's going to show up in a slight change in my emotional state, slight change in my mental state, and then a greater change in my emotions and greater change in my mental state until this activity of maintaining my center of gravity, standing up, paddling on a paddleboard, is going to be a place where I'm going to feel, I feel good because I effectively met that challenge. I like the discussion of intelligences. When we were growing up, pretty much all the intelligence we ever talked about was IQ. I think that was designed by people who had high IQs in order to stack the playing field, to disadvantage other people. It was designed for one group of people to the disadvantage of a lot of other group of people. It's recognized now, fortunately, that there are a lot of other intelligences. Basically, 7 or 8 is the current number. Physical intelligence, musical intelligence, spatial intelligence, social intelligence, emotional intelligence, and so on. And you can say, there's clearly differences in people's intelligences when we look at those. And I'm wondering if that my challenge with the paddleboard is related to physical intelligence. I don't really wonder. I've already concluded that to be true. And specifically related to having intelligent feet. If I want to define intelligence as the effective processing of information for the purpose of making decisions so I can control systems, I think it's true. It's true. Because when you're standing on a paddleboard or on a surfboard, as I see people out there surfing in the bay, that they are controlling the boards, not with their hands, not with their eyes, not with their elbows. They're controlling it with their feet. Their feet, they're driving the boards with their feet. You go, wow, that's foot intelligence. I think so. Looking back now, I recognize that I didn't understand that. I didn't understand it in terms of paddleboarding. And about a year or so ago, maybe a little bit longer, I tried to learn how to do windsurfing in the Bahamas, and I largely was unsuccessful, basically falling in the water more than, often than not, because I was essentially standing on the board as if the board was the ground and the ground was just shaking and moving based upon the wind and the water, and I wasn't trying to control the board. I was trying to just control my center of gravity instead of using the intelligence that would be in my body to control the board with these factors of wind and water and shifting and so on. And so looking at that activity, that the wind comes into the sail, into the mast, into my hands, which are holding the mast, down into my body, and then into the windsurfing board, then I would have been able to control it more effectively. I didn't understand that. And so that lack of awareness that there's meeting a challenge, that lack of awareness, that mentally not knowing, in order to succeed at that physical activity, I needed some mental awareness that I didn't have. And as I'm talking right now, I've yet to prove this point that I can acquire it. I will. I'm thinking that dancing is feet intelligence in action. And if you think of it, it's like, oh, a person's, they're moving their feet. A Fred Astaire, for instance, or a Ginger Rogers, that's enormous physical intelligence. If you'd look at typing fast and accurately, or playing the piano well, or drawing with pen, pencil, chalk, or something of that, are what I would call hand intelligences. You go, this is cool. This is cool. They can move information in such a way they can control a system, a pen, a keyboard, and so on. Makes perfect sense. I mentioned starting points when I was talking earlier about where to place the wrists on a keyboard before you start typing, or where to place your feet on a paddleboard before you start paddling, or where you would place your hands on a piano relative to middle C before you start playing a piece. Those activities, getting arranged, getting placed, getting set, are primarily visual, physical, while dancing is different. It requires the processing of auditory information as well, right? The beat of the music, which we hear, and then we translate it somehow into the body movement in the same rhythm. So the head, the arms, the hands, the hips, the legs, the feet all move in harmony with the beat of that music within those rhythms. And you would go, ah, I get it, I get it. Now, all of these things, paddle boarding and all other challenges, not just typing on a keyboard or playing the piano or dancing, all of these challenges are as fun as we make them by our interpretation, or they're as difficult and as disturbing as we make them. Here's a way to look at the idea of meeting a challenge. If we perceive the challenge as a threatening demand, we will tend to fight or run away from it as a way to meet that challenge. We will go caveman. This basically amounts to us dominating, overpowering, trying to completely control the threat, or running from it, trying not to notice it, or avoiding it completely. Both fight or flight are indications of rejecting. We think we're going to be healthier, happier, safer, all this thing, more successful if we reject threats. That basically is a caveman approach to things. While if we push away something, we reject something one way or another physically, we're going to go, ah, that's all there is to it. It's over, it's done. No, it's not. No, it's not. The vibration of rejection persists. It may start with a thought and a feeling, and we may think it only lasts as long as that single physical act, but it doesn't. It persists. It persists so much that the vibration of rejection can start to dissolve the bonds between the cells in the human body. Christ says in the book, Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth, that rejecting leads to illness. I've noticed, since I've been studying this since October 2010, that clients who seem the most rejecting are the most ill. Now, I actually believe that rejecting is the common denominator in people with illness, people with serious problems, people with poverty, people with weight issues, and on and on. It occurs to me, too, politically, that if a person or a group wanted to spread disease in the easiest way would be to convince people to be rejecting. So this group, and you see it in the media, promote rejection. And what's going to happen to that is people start to reject other people, reject other ethnicities, other religions, other races, other political points of view. And what happens now, this vibration of rejection soaks in and it penetrates the body of the person who buys into this stuff. And when that rejecting becomes self-rejecting, and that's inevitable, it's inevitable, then the disempowerment of that individual is nearing completion, because we would have lost our ability to bond, to create, to collect, and to cooperate. And that is mighty, mighty harmful on an individual level and on a human, community, social standpoint. I believe this to be true, that I could say that all conditions of imbalance, to include weight, finances, health, work, human conflict, are symptoms of rejection. You might want to entertain one or more of these questions, or not. Who rejected you? Who rejected your body, your existence, your individuality, your sovereignty over your space, over your boundaries, over your being, doing, and having, over your identity. And then, how did you continue that process of self-rejection? How did you interpret this information in such a way as to self-reject in various areas? I think we could go to these questions. How does rejection lead to financial struggles, weight issues, health issues, work issues? I'm convinced that they do. And in fact, my journaling on a daily basis has now taken a turn in that direction to look at that. Rejection at the root of so many of our problems. If we can perceive a challenge from a higher viewpoint so it's not a threat, we're going to have more access to higher vibration energy, greater awareness, more support, the support that's defined in the truth of existence, right? Growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, rhythm, all within a spiritual system of law and order. But we've got to open our awareness to that. By looking deeper at the challenges with the attitude that there is a bonding solution that will meet that challenge, we're going to open ourselves to receiving awareness from a still higher place, higher than any human stadium. Even though human consciousness is geared to perceive threats faster than pleasure, we don't have to act upon that initial impulse of rejecting. We can simply notice the impulse, maintain our balance being our spiritual, our mental, emotional, and physical balance, and then we can choose to bond with the pearl of opportunity and good that invariably is going to be inside of that challenge. It is going to cause us to reach out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness. That's the value of these challenges. They are life-enhancing. They provide us with a growth opportunity and an opportunity to fulfill our needs. Bonding, not rejecting, is going to lead to health. Love, not rejecting, is what leads to everything of a higher value that all of us want. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 of Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.